As you know, our fifth programme includes a project entitled The Review and Consolidation of the Law of Sexual Offences. And it will include, as you can see from the description in our programme, that it includes several procedural issues and evidential issues, like, for example, sexual history evidence, the corroboration rule and so forth. However, in this presentation, I just want to concentrate on something more specific, which is about consolidating the actual substantive law on sexual offences. And by substantive law, I simply mean the definitions of the offences themselves and bringing them all together, if at all possible, as it will be, I think, into a single statute. Now, of course, there's a lot of different things going on in that regard. The working group, of which I'm chairperson in the department, which has been set up by the Minister for Justice, and which we hopefully will have completed its work by the end of this year, is dealing with a number of procedural matters as well. The idea being to look at the experience of vulnerable witnesses within the system. Of course, vulnerable witnesses would be primarily complainants and victims, but also includes defendants and others who may be called upon to give evidence. And hopefully that will be of some assistance as well. There's probably a great deal that can be done in that regard without the need for legislation, because very often the most, and this has been proved, of course, in empirical research over the last 40 years, that very often the greatest need and the greatest desire that victims have is actually information, just to know what is happening and to be kept aware of it. Going slightly off the point, but just in light of what has been said already, I mean, there was one major study which I often felt could be easily replicated or could usefully be replicated in this country by Joanna Shapland back in the 1980s, where they actually followed a cohort of people who had been victimised by various kinds of crime in a particular era in the West Midlands area of England, and they followed them right throughout the system. Of course, there was a lot of attrition in the process, but what they did in the course of that follow-up was to ask them at each stage of the process, you know, what their reaction was or what their response was. And strangely enough, in terms of what victims wanted, at the end of the day, when it was all added up, strangely enough, punishment wasn't even their first consideration. It was actually their third. Their first consideration was information. Their second was compensation. And then the third was punishment. So it shows the importance of undertaking empirical research from time to time into what is the experience of victims when you talk to them individually. But that's just by the way. However, we're talking here, what I'm going to talk about is the whole consolidation issue. And the main justification for consolidation is that the criminal law in general should be clear and accessible to all. Ideally, all the substantive criminal law should be available in a relatively small number of statutes. Of course, we heard talk earlier on today about the Road Traffic Acts, which I certainly agree badly need to be consolidated. You know, there have been efforts made from time to time, such as the Road Traffic Amendment Act of 2011, which usefully brought together at long last modern definitions of careless driving, dangerous driving and so forth. But there is a need for somebody. It doesn't have to be, certainly I don't think the Law Reform Commission can do it, but some other organisation, you know, helped by government, to produce a consolidated Road Traffic Act. It has already been done, of course, in relation to assault and property offences. Again, as it happens, as a result of reports in the past by this commission, so that the Non-Fatal Offences Against the Person Act of 1997 and the Criminal Justice Theft and Fraud Offences Act of 2001, which, you know, respectively, effectively codify assault offences and property offences, they have proved to be remarkably resilient, even with some amendments. But we need a system, of course, which allows for amended versions of core statutes to be promulgated as soon as amendments are made. So therefore, it should be possible to go onto the internet today and to get a version, an official version, that is, of, let's say, the Theft Act of 2001 as it stands today, not as it stood back in 2001. For example, if you go on to look at the New Zealand Crimes Act of 1961, which is effectively a criminal code, which consists of 415 sections, But yet, if you consult it online today, you will find a version of the Act as it stood on the 1st of July 2019, with brief annotations indicating appeals and amendments. Now, as it happens, this Commission has an ongoing project on this more general question of updating legislation. But the law relating to sexual offences is a matter of particular importance and concern for reasons that we have just heard, and therefore we have decided to undertake this review and consolidation exercise. Two reasons, well, apart from that general reason, I suppose there are two reasons in relation to sex offences. One is that, like many other areas of law, sexual offences are dispersed among over at least a dozen statutes dating back to the mid-19th century. I think it's true to say that if you want to find out the maximum sentence for rape, you have to go back to Section 48 of the Offence Against the Person Act of 1861. Some sections of the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885 are still in force, and indeed it's not all that long since we had a prosecution for indecency under the Vagrancy Act of 1824. But having said that, most of our law on sexual offences is contained in statutes that were enacted since the early 1980s, since about 1981. But there have been a lot of them, and therefore the time has now come to engage in some degree of consolidation. I might add, just in passing, I'm tending to use here the words consolidation and codification somewhat interchangeably. They're not exactly identical. There's no formal definition of either of them. But generally speaking, when we talk about consolidation, we're talking about a fairly simple exercise in which you bring all the existing law together in a systematic way, whereas codification usually involves some degree of reform as well. I suppose, really, we are talking about, in effect, codification in that sense rather than consolidation. In addition to that, there is some definition, some overlap among offence definitions. I'm not sure there's very much that can be done about that, but for example, there will be overlaps in definitions at the moment between incest, what we now call defilement, and even rape. For example, if a man had sexual intercourse with his 60-year-old daughter, well, he could be prosecuted for incest, he could be prosecuted for defilement, he could be prosecuted for rape. As it happens, all three offences now carry quite different maximum sentences, which means, of course, there's a great deal of prosecutorial discretion involved. I'm not suggesting this is a huge problem, but it does point, if you like, to the value of having a systematic review of all sexual offences where these, if at all possible, overlaps can be addressed or ironed out, rather than have piecemeal episodic amendments. So in relation then to sex offences and consolidating them, there are a couple of, I won't call them problems or insurmountable problems, but issues that arise. One is that we have, of course, a very significant number of still prosecutions for so-called historic abuse, for want of a better term. If you were to go into the Central Criminal Court today, and if there was a sexual offence trial going on, there's a possibility it might relate to something that happened 2 years ago. There's an equal possibility it may happen to something that happened 32 years ago, or indeed longer, and I've seen such cases. And therefore, the law that is applicable, of course, in those historic cases, as I call them, is the law that applied when the offence was actually committed. Under the Interpretation Act, a prosecution may be brought for a repealed offence, provided, of course, that the alleged conduct was committed while that offence existed. Now, this does not apply, obviously, if the section in question was repealed by virtue of being found unconstitutional, as happened with the unlawful carnal knowledge offences back in the mid-2000s. But if part of that, a prosecution may be brought for a repealed offence. And therefore, very recently, the Supreme Court rejected a challenge to the constitutionality of the offence of gross indecency between males, contrary to an Act of 1885, which means that that offence can still be prosecuted, even though, in fact, it was repealed by statute in 1993. So if the conduct is alleged to have occurred prior to 1993, a prosecution can still be brought for it, at least in some circumstances. So therefore, it means that a consolidated statute which sets out all sexual offences has a challenge to meet, because it will set out the law as it now exists. It will set out the present law, but it won't necessarily set out all the applicable law, because the applicable law will include, of course, offences that are no longer in existence. Then on the other side of the coin, statutory provisions creating new offences cannot, of course, be applied retrospectively. For example, the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act of 2017, and this was a welcome development, it created 6 new offences of child sexual exploitation, which were badly needed, I might add, and had been for a very long time. But, of course, a person may not be prosecuted for any of those offences if the alleged conduct occurred before the 27th of March 2017, which was the date on which those sections came into operation. It is a fundamental principle of legality, which is protected by both the Constitution and also by the European Convention on Human Rights, that the criminal law cannot be applied retrospectively, or at least a substantive criminal law cannot be applied retrospectively, and that a heavier penalty may not be imposed than the maximum that existed when the offence was committed. That's set out very clearly in Article 7 of the European Convention on Human Rights, partly also expressly protected by our Constitution, and the rest of it is implicitly protected by the Constitution as a result of the Enright case. But the Article 7 of the Convention says, no one shall be held guilty of a criminal offence on account of any act or omission that did not constitute a criminal offence under national or international law at the time when the offence was committed, nor shall a heavier penalty be imposed than the one that was applicable at the time the criminal offence was committed. So therefore, you can only the maximum sentence that applies to an offence is that which applied when the offence was actually committed. And therefore, heavier penalties cannot be applied retrospectively, obviously. What sometimes happens now is rare enough. It's happened twice in this country where, let's say, the maximum penalty may actually be reduced between the time at which the offence was committed and the time at which the person has been sentenced. That would have happened throughout the 1990s with sexual assault, where sexual assault, or what we used to call indecent assault, had a maximum sentence of 10 years imprisonment as of 1981, but that was reduced to 5 years imprisonment in 1990, and that lasted until 2001. From the year 1995 up until this year, a few months ago, incest by a male carried a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. As of a few months ago, it now carries the maximum sentence of 10 years imprisonment. So what happens then if a person has been sentenced today for an offence that was committed at a time when it carried a higher maximum sentence than it does now? Well, that is, it tracks what we sometimes call the in mitius principle, or the lex mitior. It's a general principle of international law, we think now, that a person should always get the benefit of the more lenient sentence. That is not written specifically into the European Convention on Human Rights. It is written specifically into the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But the European Convention of Human Rights doesn't confer any express right to be given the benefit of a more lenient penalty that now applies. However, rather controversially, about a decade ago, well, sorry, 10 years ago now, the European Court of Human Rights, in a case called Scopola and Italy, decided that this leniency principle was to be read into Article 7 of the European Convention of Human Rights. And it said that, when the law becomes more lenient between the time of the commission of the offence and the time of sentence, then the defendant should get the benefit of the more lenient measure, as it happens. So, for example, under the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Amendment Act of 2019, as I said a moment ago, the maximum sentence for incest by a male has been reduced to 10 years, and the maximum sentence for incest by a female has been increased from 7 years to 10 years. So if, therefore, let's say, a male were now convicted of an incest offence committed in 2016, with the maximum sentence of life imprisonment, well, then under Scopola, he would be now subject to a maximum sentence of 10 years because it's the more lenient measure. But if a woman was being sentenced today for a sentence for incest committed in 2016 when the maximum sentence was 7 years, she would still be entitled to the benefit of the maximum sentence for 7 years because it's now 10 years and a higher maximum sentence cannot be applied retrospectively. So it can get a little bit complicated in terms of, what maximum sentences actually apply to historic sex offences. I mean, it's not a big issue legally, But in terms of, if you like, consolidating the law, then it is something that we have to have regard to. But it shouldn't be, in terms of producing a draft statute, it shouldn't be by any means impossible, because we have to kind of take advantage again of technology that we were talking about earlier on, in terms, if you like, of how we draft statutes and how we present them. About 20 years ago, Richard Susskind, one of the great prophets of the impact of technology on law, drew a distinction between what he called automation and innovation. Automation is when we use technology to perform tasks in pretty much the same way as they were previously performed by humans. An ATM machine would be a very good example of that. And so far, the law has concentrated very much on automation. This is true as far as legal documentation is concerned. You know, the statutes, the law reports, so forth, that appear online are pretty much the same, in fact, identical with those that appear in print. Innovation is about exploiting technology to do things a bit differently and to do things a bit better. So I think that one of the things that we, not just we, but other countries, and they are already doing it, in terms of producing consolidated statutes and draft statutes, is to produce them sometimes in a three-dimensional way, perhaps, or with appropriate annotations and so forth, that will allow users to discover not just what the law is now, but also to identify any applicable law that may be still potentially applicable to cases because they relate to incidents that occurred in the past. But that's just, if you like, the more technical side of it. I want to move on then to look at what I call the values that should inform consolidation. There are three values in brief terms: economy, clarity, and comprehensiveness. Economy is about, if you like, having as few offences as possible that will cover all of the conduct that we want to outlaw. An unnecessary multiplicity of offences with overlapping definitions can serve to obscure the law and to make it less accessible. For instance, I don't regard the English Sexual Offences Act of 2003 as being a particularly good model to adopt, because the first 71 sections of it create various offences, probably more than necessary, and they do overlap. The equivalent Scottish Act from 2009 is probably a better model. This is, of course, the second criminal offences, of course, should also be clearly defined. This, again, is a very central element of the principle of legality, which is, again, protected under our Constitution and the European Convention. And it derives, excuse me, from the more fundamental principle of fairness that people should be able to discover with reasonable ease exactly what is prohibited by the law and what is not. And then thirdly, a codified statute or consolidated statute should be comprehensible as well, but it should be comprehensive and coherent by including all necessary offences defined in such a way that they overlap as little as possible. Maximum sentences should be determined in accordance with the principle of ordinal proportionality, which means that the heaviest should be reserved for the most serious offences, with less severe maximum sentences for less serious offences. Having said this, no statute, however comprehensive, no consolidated statute, however comprehensive, can be guaranteed to remain adequate to deal with all the eventualities that may arise. There will always be new issues arising, especially at the present time, when in relation to sex offences, the internet and the social media are being used in ever more creative ways for the purposes of engaging in exploitative activity. So Parliament, therefore, must be prepared and be free, which, of course, under our Constitution it is, to engage in lawmaking, but especially interstitial lawmaking, by filling in any gaps that emerge in existing legislation. And if you want an example of that, it happened just about 2 years ago. For example, as I said to you earlier on, the Criminal Law Sex Offences Act of 2017 created what we thought was a very comprehensive range of child exploitation offences. And one of those was the offence in Section 7 of travelling to meet a child that you had already been in contact with for the purposes of engaging in sexual activity with the child, a grooming offence, in other words. And that was that applies to a child where the child is under the age of 17 years. But yet no sooner was the ink dry in the paper when a new problem arose, And this related to persons who were subject to sting operations by vigilante groups. And these were people who believed that they were actually communicating with the child and travelled to meet the child and all the rest of it. But when they got there, they found that they were met by a group of vigilantes who proceeded to have them arrested. Now, of course, there can be no doubt about the moral guilt of somebody who does that. They had the clear, unambiguous intention of engaging in the abuse of a child. But were they guilty of an offence? Well, as the section was written, they were not. But I do know that it has been possible in some cases to argue, and I think successfully, that they would be guilty of attempting to commit the offence, even though it would be a case of attempting the impossible. And we think, and I emphasise, we think that under Irish law, attempting the impossible is an attempt. So, I mean, that is just an indication there, if you like, the three values that I believe should inform consolidation: economy, clarity and comprehensiveness. Now, I just said a bit there in the paper, but I'm not going to say anything more about it here, but it just has to do with the economy issue, because, of course, over the last 10 or 12 years, anyone who's interested in, if you like, academic criminal law will know that the focus of attention has shifted quite a lot. Any of you who did criminal law in the past will know that, well, all the kind of cutting-edge work was about actus reus, mens rea, and so on. That's still very important. But a lot of the cutting-edge work for the last decade has been about criminalisation. The idea, what are the factors that should be taken into account to criminalise more and more conduct? A few incidents, if you like, sparked off this interest. One was a major book by Doug Husak, a leading American scholar, about over-criminalisation, which was very influential. The other, however, was empirical research that was carried out in these islands, especially in England, about the extent to which governments, and especially newly elected governments, actually create new criminal offences. For example, the new Labour government, when it came to power in 1997, created 1,235 new criminal offences during its first year in office. And by 2006, when it was 10 years in office, it had created a total of 3,600 new criminal offences. Now, of course, a lot of those were done by way of delegated legislation, and a lot of them resulted from membership of the EU, so it's no wonder, I suppose, they want to quit. But the Conservative Lib Dem government, that was the one that was led by Dave and Nick, was a bit more restrained because it only created 634 new criminal offences during its first year in office. This has led to, if you like, a strong and, I believe, well-justified critical stance by criminal law scholars into the whole question of criminalisation and why it's happening. A lot of the offences being created are what we call non-consummate offences or pre-inchoate offences. Non-consummate offences are offences where the conduct element of itself doesn't cause any harm. In other words, something like possession of drugs or firearms. You know, if you just possess drugs, that in itself does not cause harm. But we criminalise it because of the risk that's involved. So an awful lot of our criminal law today and all of the thousands of offences that have been created, especially under terrorism legislation and other kinds of legislation, have been about their reduction of risk. But, of course, they do bring more and more people within the net of the criminal justice system. I mention that because it's something that we have to bear in mind in the area of sex offences as well. Though I would think the general view, and I'm not the only one to have this view, by the way, it's also a view shared by many of some of the people who have written some of the leading works on criminalisation, is that sex offences is probably an exception in that possibly until recently we didn't have too many of them. We probably had too few of them. Certainly it was true in this country that until 2017 there were many serious gaps in our law in relation to child exploitation. So therefore, we have a balance to strike between, on the one hand, trying to be as comprehensive as possible, but on the other, if you like, not leading to over-criminalisation. So in conclusion then, I just want to mention what I put there in the paper, only three fairly randomly chosen examples of issues that might arise when we come to look at, if you like, consolidating the substantive law on sex offences. And I've just kind of isolated out three topics. One is rape. Again, we have modern definitions of it. The report that we produced last week, if it's implemented, will if you like, update the definition insofar as the mens rea of rape is concerned. But actually, we have two offences of rape known to this in this jurisdiction, as you probably know. You have the offence we were dealing with last week, which is what we often call common law rape, and that is rape which can only be committed by a male against a female. And then we have Section 4 rape, Section 4 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, or Criminal Law Rape Amendment Act of 1990, which is more gender neutral, either male or female may be victims of it, and to some extent also perpetrators of it, and it also covers other forms of sexual penetration. So, I mean, I think there probably is a good case at this point, I don't think it would be very controversial, to have a single offence of rape that would cover all forms of sexual penetration. And I have quoted there from, for example, the French Penal Code, which was amended last year. And again, as you can see when you read it, it simply provides that every act of sexual penetration of whatever kind committed on another person or on the person of the perpetrator by violence, coercion, threat or surprise is rape. And likewise, that is true in the English Sexual Offences Act as well, where, you know, you have a single offence of rape, which is by virtue of sexual penetration. And again, they adopt that act a system that we might or might not want to approach. Instead of talking about the accused or the complainant or whoever, they simply mention the parties as A, B and C. Well, maybe there's something to be said about that. As I said there, it certainly is preferable to Baroness Hale's choice of terminology in a case called the Crown against G, where she was dealing with underage rape, and she insisted on referring to the male as the possessor of the penis. Well, I don't think that we will be adopting that particular terminology in this country. But in any event, that's one issue. The other issue is the issue of consent, which, again, we have a modern definition of, which is in the 2017 Act. What that section was due to do, what was intended to do, was to, if you like, embrace the existing common law definition with all the various circumstances in which consent is presumed to be absent. It still remains a very contentious issue. We're not the only ones who are grappling with this. Many other countries are trying to grapple with it as well. It's all very well to talk about consent being absent when there's any kind of force or fear or fraud or misrepresentation as to the nature of the act or the identity of the actor and so on. But when you have more subtle forms of pressure being applied, I mean, does that negate consent? Supposing, for example, a teacher or a lecturer says to a student, I will fail you in your examination unless you have sexual intercourse with me. And the student does. Is that an absence of, is that rape? Is that the absence of consent? Supposing instead the teacher, the student or the lecturer says, well, I have looked at your exam, I have corrected your exam paper, you merit a 2-1, but I'll give you a first if you have sexual intercourse with me. Would that be different, I wonder, if the student had sexual intercourse with the professor at that stage? Would that be rape? Would that be absence of consent? These are the kind of subtleties that are there, and it's actually quite difficult to grapple with them. Second issue I suppose we have to deal with is the age of consent. Now, again, this has been addressed, of course, it was a big, big issue after the Supreme Court struck down the unlawful carnal knowledge offences back in 2006. And the question arises, should we in fact have an age of consent as high as 17 years? In fact, what people don't often realise, it's actually 18 years in this country now since 2017. If one of the parties is a person in authority, because Section 18 of the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act of 2017 provides that it is an offence for a person in authority to engage in certain sexual acts with a person, a child, aged between 17 and 18. So, for example, a parent, a teacher, a guardian or whoever who has intercourse or indeed engages in other acts with a person aged between 17 and 18 is guilty of an offence. So we have to ask ourselves this question. Obviously, the real issue is not about is whether we should criminalise, if you like, sexual relations between people in their mid-teens. We're not talking about exploitative activity, you know, by adults of children. You could wear that. But what about 2 16-year-olds? I mean, the so-called Romeo and Juliet law, though, as I say there in the paper, I couldn't resist putting it in, that it's a rather inapt description, because in Shakespeare's play, we know that Juliet is just under 14 years, but at no point, strange enough, have we ever told what age Romeo was. I once heard Germaine Greer say he was probably about 20, so that must be right then. But according to Google, he was 16 or 17. Doesn't matter. But what's interesting about it is that in the first act of the play, when Lady Capulet, Julia's mother, is giving out about the fact that that daughter of hers still isn't married, she says, well, what age is she anyway? In those days, ladies had more to think about than their children's ages, although, of course, she herself was only 28 at the time. But the nurse tells her, well, she's 14, or she will be 14 in 2 weeks' time. And Lady Capulet says, but I was already her mother when I was 14, which, of course, would have been true. At that age, girls could be married once they reach the age of 12. And so the age of consent has varied throughout history, across time and place. In Ireland, certainly, the 17-year upper limit, 18 if you want, but 17 in general, is probably high by European standards. But on the other hand, I suppose we did mitigate the rigours of it somewhat in 2017 when we introduced the so-called young person's defence, which means that it is a defence to a person who has sexual relations with a person aged between 15 and 17, provided there was consent and provided that the, it's hard to know what expression to use, the offender, whatever, was either younger or not more than 2 years older than the child in question. I'm just mentioning that as another issue on which we will no doubt be inviting submissions as to whether the age of consent should be revisited, but maybe not. I'm not suggesting it should be. And then it comes to incest. Finally, this is the last and I'll finish with this. Again, a contested issue. Do we need it at all, actually? It's committed by a man, as you know, who has sexual intercourse with his mother, sister, daughter or granddaughter, and by a woman aged 17 or over who permits her father, grandfather, brother or son to have sexual intercourse with her. There's a whole controversy among historians. It was only introduced into our law in 1908. That was the first time it became an offence in either this country or in Britain, or certainly in England and Wales. It only includes sexual intercourse in the traditional sense of the word, and it's only committed between blood relatives. Is that any longer needed? Well, it doesn't seem to be prosecuted very often nowadays, and this is scarcely surprising because in practice it overlaps with defilement offences. In other words, it's typically committed by a man against his daughter who is under the age of consent, or a brother against a younger sister who is under the age of consent. Now, I'm not saying they're the only situations. We had, of course, a very tragic and well-known case some years ago of incest committed by a mother against her son. But the defilement offences, if you like, already cover much of that behaviour. And the maximum sentence, the defilement offences, of course, now carry heavier maximum sentences as well. However, there's no age limit for incest. It may be committed by consenting adults if they are within the prescribed degrees of consanguinity, that's blood relationship. So an adult brother and sister who have sexual intercourse are guilty of incest, even if both are fully consenting, even if there is no risk of pregnancy. The question arises, should that be a matter that is appropriate for regulation by the criminal law? There may well be, as they say, it would be have problems in other areas. It would certainly be a dysfunctional family relationship or whatever. The same would be true, let's say, between a man and his adult daughter. As I say, there is a question as to whether that kind of consensual incestuous behaviour between adults should be criminal. As it happens, the matter came before the European Court of Human Rights again back in 2012 in a case called Stubing and Germany. And it was one of those cases which you only thought existed in textbooks, where a brother and sister who were separated at birth and were put into separate foster homes met in later years and they began to have sexual relations. And they had a number of children, actually, and then they were prosecuted. or at least the man in question, I think, was prosecuted, and it came up before the European Court of Human Rights on the question of whether that violated the right to privacy under Article 8. Strangely enough, the European Court of Human Rights upheld the German law, or didn't find it to be incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights, but it did so on a basis that it occasionally uses, and which I, for one, don't particularly like, where it says that, you know, states have a margin of appreciation, as they call it, in deciding on the ambit of rights to privacy and so forth. And when they come then to assessing, is this within the margin of appreciation, they tend to do a grand tour of all the different countries and say, well, how many countries actually outlaw incest in those circumstances? And they found that, generally speaking, quite a few countries did. And so they said, well, in that case, it's okay. It's one of those cases where the court tends to follow rather than to lead, as arguably it should. However, as I say, I just mentioned that as another question that we will look at. It may well be that, for example, the offence of incest, as it now is in some countries, would continue to exist insofar as it might be committed against persons under a certain age, but not insofar as it would relate to consensual sexual behaviour. So there's much more that we could talk about, but we have another few years to do it. So thank you very much.